will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum, so we'll wait just a minute. Mr. Benson, my understanding is you have a bill that was heard in the Housing Committee today.
That's right.
And because it has the use of a new mechanism that we haven't used before except for the stadium at the University of Minnesota, we thought, so that it's not a surprise to this committee, we would hear not the bill, which was heard in committee and which that committee will be making a recommendation to us about, but we would focus on this new mechanism and what motivated this direction. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm John Benson. I'm the chief author of the MHFA Appropriations Bill, House File 2535. And I'm just here because I, as I said, I'm the chief author, and also introduced Tanya Orr from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, who is an expert in this area and will clarify and explain in good detail this new funding mechanism. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In your packet, you have a folder from the Housing Finance Agency, and it has some materials on the left-hand side about the Wilder survey on homelessness, some information about progress that we've made on the plan to end long-term homelessness, and editorial and some other information. On the right-hand side, you have a few summary talking points about why we're proposing this alternative to GO bonds, and a description of the delete everything amendment, which you will, I think it will come before you at some point.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm on another committee at the moment, so unless you need me for anything, if I may be excused.
We're happy to have you join us for a while, and we'll appreciate
it. Madam Chair? Madam Chair? Do we need to move the delete all amendment and get it up?
It's going to come to us. All the bills are going to be referred by finance divisions, and so when Representative Clark comes on Monday or Tuesday, we'll see what her recommendation is about this. We'll perhaps get your motivation. This, by the way, is in the governor's bill.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's not in the governor's capital budget. It will be in the supplemental budget because we're not asking for GO bond proceeds. So the governor, in his announcement of his capital bonding bill, did reference this, but the actual language will be in the supplemental budget. So we are, this is a continuation of our effort to try and develop 4,000 housing opportunities for people who are experiencing long-term homelessness, meaning people who have been on the streets without a permanent place to live for at least 12 months or multiple occasions in the last 3 years. So we've launched the plan in 2004. We've made a lot of progress on the plan. We've developed over 1,600 housing opportunities since 2004. This capital bonding request capital investment request is the last request that we will make under the plan that would be exclusively for permanent supportive housing for long-term homeless. So there's a lot of information in your packet about the need. You have in the past funded this effort for the last two bonding cycles, and we're hoping that you will continue and help us meet our goal. We need to produce 800 housing opportunities each of the next 2 years, so it's a very aggressive goal. The $30 million that we're asking for would produce about 250 to 300 units. As the chair mentioned, we are proposing a new mechanism for funding the capital costs of this housing. We have used, the Housing Finance Agency has used general obligation bonds since 1990, and we have used them successfully, but it's not been without its trials and tribulations. There are a couple of reasons why general obligation bond proceeds don't work particularly well for housing. One of them, the biggest one, is that the housing has to be publicly owned. Some communities are perfectly willing to be a public owner of housing, But there are a lot of communities that don't have any experience with that and are reluctant to do it. It takes them into a world that they're not used to, and they just really don't want to go there. So it often means that we have a nonprofit organization who's willing to operate the housing and develop it, but has to spend a lot of time negotiating with various local units of government to find a public owner. That does slow things down and sometimes and does complicate things frequently. We also have found that a lot of times we try to blend resources so that the housing that's being developed with the GEO bonds is a combination of long-term homeless units and other affordable housing units, so that people are integrated into the community. We don't use the GEO bonds for the other affordable housing parts of the building, but it is increasingly difficult to merge different funding sources because of the constitutional requirements. Our favorite example is the Lutheran Social Services project. That's a 48-unit housing project in Minneapolis that we use GEO bonds for a portion of to fund the long-term homeless units, 10 of those units. But because we were using a multitude of resources that included GEO bonds, we had to do things differently than we would if we hadn't used general obligation bond proceeds. We had to have a separate elevator. The hallways had to be constructed differently. We had to worry about a separate heating system. We had to have roving easements for the parking. There were a lot of physical things that had to be done to that project that were not being driven by the project itself, but were being driven by the GEO bond portion of the financing. It adds cost. It adds cost both in terms of the actual construction, and it adds cost in terms of attorney's fees. And we've been searching for a way to avoid that. So what we're proposing is that instead of the state issuing general obligation bonds for the permanent supportive housing, that the Housing Finance Agency, which is the second largest issuer of bonds in the state, would issue 501c3 bonds for nonprofits to own and operate the permanent supportive housing. And we're asking the state legislature to appropriate the debt service. The debt service for $30 million worth of bonds is $2.4 million a year. We would not need to have make a debt service payment until fiscal year 2010, so July 1st of 2009. This is, in a lot of ways, very similar to what you've done in the past with general obligation bonds, is that you've made a commitment to a certain amount of money to fund projects, and then you've appropriated, as part of the bigger bill, appropriated debt service. We would manage the bond issuance so that it would fall within the $2.4 million annually. The reason that we've asked for GEO bond proceeds in the past and are now asking for this mechanism for this particular type of housing is that it is not housing that we can fund through revenue bonds. It is housing where the people have minimal, if any, income, and even if they can pay 30% of their income towards the rent, it is insufficient to pay the operating costs, let alone the debt service on these buildings. So this is housing that can't support any debt. In the past, you've been generous enough to use GEO bonds to help produce this housing. We're asking for a similar, but we think a much more efficient mechanism for funding this housing in the future. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Yes. I was hard on her this morning, so I promised I wouldn't do it this afternoon.
It was
a compliment to her.
No questions of Ms. or Representative Singleton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Orr, I have a question on one of the handouts here.
Uh-huh.
It's the one that's at the top, the summary of the Delete Everything Amendment.
Uh-huh.
The third bullet down talks about nonprofit housing bonds issued by the agency are not a debt of the state, in contrast to GEO bonds. And I guess I don't know if this is a question to Ms. Orr or maybe it's to staff. I'm thinking back last week when we talked about the transportation bill and the $60 million that's being a part of the transportation bill that is counting against our 3% limit. So with this situation, would this debt be counted against our 3% limit?
My understanding is it is not, because it is not a deal bond, and it is, we're not using our bonding authority. You're using yours. And coincidentally, members, I should tell you about the connections between past and future. It was when Ms. Orr came to my office, and I think you referenced the fact that we had used this when we did the stadium at the Gopher Stadium at the University of Minnesota. And that because they have bonding authority, as does the university, that it occurred to them that given the some of the dilemmas in bonding for nonprofits, I remember visiting the Lucian Social Service project and was told that they believed that really the cost of their project was higher just because they were needing to follow the rules of geo-bonding. And so they were seeking this. And it was... in a sense, that particular conversation that caused me to suggest to the university that couldn't that same mechanism also be used for the bioscience initiative. So that's what you'll be hearing on Thursday. I had, by the way, asked the university to visit committee members, and I don't know if that's happening, but we'll certainly check to see. That's just kind of a little bit of a distraction from the issue, but because you'll be hearing a similar proposal on Thursday, I thought I'd set it in that context.
Madam Chair, Representative Timmelstad, I thank you for pointing that out, because that is actually an important element of this, is that you're not pledging the taxing authority of the state. So that is a big distinguishing feature from DO bond. It would give the Housing Finance Agency the authority to pledge whatever payments you make to us for the debt service, but this is strictly what's called an appropriation bond. So it will be looked at as an appropriation bond.
Representative Peterson?
Following the same line of questions, then the $2.4 million principal and interest commitment appropriation will come out of the budget of bonding, or will that come out of the general budget?
Out of housing.
Out of housing. And so this is a 10-year commitment. So future legislators will be asked to honor this commitment for the next 10 years.
20.
And,
20
years, excuse me.
And we did, I mean, she did acknowledge that as we first talked about this, that there is a certain amount of risk. And we even pointed out, unlike the university when they did it to the stadium, were we to not come through with that pledge, they have the opportunity to raise the money. It's a little different from this agency because they don't have an opportunity to raise money if we fail to meet that obligation, but they feel that we have, that they've developed a trust relationship with us. That
the
we can be
agency,
trusted.
Yes. The rating agencies, one of the things that the rating agency look at is the relationship the agency has with the legislature, and one of the reasons that we have a AA+ rating is because they feel like we have a very healthy, good relationship with the legislature, and they're confident that the Minnesota legislature is very responsible and is not going to allow a default on the bonds issued by one of the best housing finance agencies in the state, in the country.
Madam Chair.
Were you finished?
Did you?
Rip this over?
Well, and this isn't the first time, or is the Twin Stadium the first time where this type of financing has taken place? The Gopher Stadium. If you recall, the two buildings that are not the Anderson Building, but the Ag Building and the Freeman Building. I guess the other one is the Anderson Building. The Health and Human Services Building. Both of them, the bonds are issued by St. Paul Port Authority. Mm-hmm. Now, they do have a backing them, but we're paying those bonds off within the budget of those particular agencies. As they come through year after year, those bond payments are a line item in their budget. If we don't appropriate enough money, they probably have that moral obligation to pay them off and lay off people. So cuts, that would be part of the decision that the bureaucracy makes. The identical same thing is true in the BCA building in Bemidji. The bond payments for that particular facility is coming out of the rent that the BCA is paying for those particulars within that sort of health and or public safety budget. Now, I think in the Bemidji case, the BCA, in that particular case, there may be at least a strong moral obligation of the state if that should fail, but the bond payments are part of the budget as opposed. But in the two buildings right down the street, they did not count as part of the 3% because they were bonds were issued by other people.
Representative Solberg, Freeman and which one?
Well, I think it's the Freeman. Is that the Ag building?
Ag and
Human,
human
Services.
Ag and Human Services.
Yeah, but I don't remember. The Revenue building is, what's the name of that one? I don't know. That's the staff. That's all. It's the Anderson and the Freeman building. The Staffen building is our general obligation bond, but the other two are Port Authority, St. Paul Port Authority bonds.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, your testimony about the government being cheaper to build this job as opposed to the general obligation bond. Are you talking about just the issuing of the bond, or are you talking about some of the requirements of the construction of the facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, no, I was referring to the construction of the project. The issuing of the bonds, we expect that we will have a rate that's, you know, within a basis point or two of what the state would if they were issuing deal bonds. It will be a similar sort of cost.
Representative Carlson. Chair, I thought that's what you meant when you were testifying. So my question is, what are some of those differences in construction and
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, those the differences are primarily relate to projects where it's not 100% deal bond funded, and we're trying to merge funding sources. So, for instance, one of the largest funding sources for affordable housing is the federal low-income tax credit. So a lot of times when we're trying to do a project that's a combination of deal bond funded and tax credits, the deal bond funded portion of the building has to be able to essentially stand on its own. So you'll have a 48 unit project, three stories. You don't want to have sort of a ghetto of the deal bond units, so they're spread throughout. We would like to have them spread throughout the project, but we can't do that because the deal bond requirements require us to make sure that if the owner of the non-public part of the building would decide to turn off the heat, we have to have heat in that building. So we have to have a separate heating system. Even though we could have a heating system to heat the whole 48 units, we have to have a separate one. If the owner would decide they didn't want to have the public owner residence using the elevator and shuts down the elevator, we have to have a separate elevator. So it's those sorts of things that it's mostly, it is in those situations when we're trying to integrate long-term homeless units, in this case, with other affordable housing units that we run into the trouble.
Ms. Orr, there were a few people who had asked to testify, and maybe we could have them testify, and then if we have either more questions or for this. Kip Paulback from the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm here, Chip Halbach, from the Housing Partnership, and I'm here to speak on both behalf of the bonding amount itself, the $30 million for supportive housing, and the bonding mechanism that Tanya Orr just described. And The Housing Partnership is a united effort of representatives from business, nonprofit agencies, and local government, and we engage in public policy work. And also, we work mostly in rural communities around the state with local government and nonprofit agencies to produce affordable housing. We've been involved in a number of affordable housing projects and supportive housing projects over the years. I'm here today filling in for one of our board members, Alan Arthur, who's in addition to being on the board of our organization, is the president of nonprofit agency AON, or formerly Central Community Housing Trust, which in his testimony this morning, if I could pass out this document.
We have somebody who can do that for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
His agency in downtown St. Paul redeveloped the Crane Ordway building, and that property is a perfect example of what can be done with this new funding mechanism. The Crane Ordway is a 70-unit, very affordable apartment building that has 14 unit set aside for long-term homeless individuals. So it's exactly the type of mixed-use building, and also developed and owned by a nonprofit agency that the funding mechanism that Tanya Orde described would work for. This property had been vacant for some 30 years before the redevelopment, and the AON was able to use different types of tax credit from the federal government, historic and low income, to actually provide most of the capital from it. But in the future, if this mechanism goes through, this new bonding approach, this type of property would be an example of what could be done in the state. So again, we are in favor of both the mechanism and the $30 million for supportive housing. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. George Stone, Corporation for Supportive Housing, Minnesota.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee. My name is George Stone. I'm with the Corporation for Supportive Housing. I am the director of the Minnesota program. I just want to thank you, first of all, for giving me the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2535, the request for $30 million in nonprofit bonds to advance the state's business plan to end long-term homelessness. My organization, Corporation for Supportive Housing, CSH, is a national organization that helps communities create permanent housing with services to prevent and end homelessness. And since opening our office in 1993 here in Minnesota, CSH has provided our expertise and financial resources to hundreds of partners throughout the state to help create supportive housing opportunities for Minnesotans experiencing homelessness. More specifically, Minnesotans not only experiencing homelessness, but whose housing instability is exacerbated by additional barriers such as mental illness, chemical dependency, and disabling health conditions. CSH and many of our partners were elated when the state launched its plan in 2004, and the plan is an ambitious one, yeah, but it's also well-researched, it's got quantifiable needs and achievable outcomes. The plan identifies supportive housing as a primary strategy in ending long-term homelessness, and providing people with permanent housing coupled with supports that they need to stay stably housed is a tested and proven practice. Supportive housing not only results in improved outcomes for the individuals and families living there, but it uses scarce public resources more effectively by ending homelessness rather than managing it. Traditionally, communities across the nation, not just Minnesota, have struggled by trying to manage homelessness through expensive crisis-related interventions such as prisons, jails, detox, hospitals, and other types of settings. Permanent supportive housing is a better investment. I often am asked the question, especially when we have a $30 million request in front of you, is this money enough to do what you want? Is this money enough to end homelessness? And it's not, quite frankly, a simple question. First, I'd start by saying yes. It represents the last capital request related to the plan, and when 250 units are coupled with the other resources that we've used to help create units and housing opportunities, it will help us achieve our goal of creating 4,000 supportive housing opportunities here in Minnesota. And it's, now, it doesn't address the service needs of the long-term homeless. That I would acknowledge and say that we are working with the legislature, and the legislature has been very good so far in helping to create resources to address those service needs. And no, the state plan does not address the needs of every person who experiences homelessness. But it isn't focused on an important subpopulation of the overall homeless, the long-term homeless. And while there are a number of worthy housing requests which absolutely need to be addressed, CSH supports the state's strategy to create a short-term priority to house the long-term homeless. We believe that this is a population that's been marginalized, overlooked, and devastated for years, sometimes decades, by homelessness. It's a minority of the population of the homeless who use the majority of the public's resources, most often resulting in little or no improvement in their housing status, their health, or other indicators of well-being. And by supporting and putting new resources into the long-term homeless, we have seen this as being a good thing for the overall affordable housing industry. As I mentioned, this request will keep the state on pace to meet their goals, and I would categorize it quickly in three broad areas: leadership, resources, and partners. Leadership has come from the public sector and the private sector. The public sector has included the governor's office, the legislature, and many of our state agencies, in particular, Minnesota Housing. An example of the leadership and innovation can be seen in the nonprofit revenue bonds that have been outlined earlier by Ms. Orr. And we strongly support this approach and the opportunities for increased efficiency, accessibility, and ability to leverage funding that it represents. Two, resources. We couldn't do this without the money. The legislature has allocated new resources, including $45 million plus in GO bonds, and nearly 100% of that has been committed to date, creating over 350 units around the state. I provided a handout for you, which you can reference. This is an example of the variety of different projects that had been created or are in creation right now using the previously allocated bonding authority through the state. And the partners. This obviously would not be possible if we did not have a group of ready, willing, and capable project sponsors to use those resources that have been allocated. You have one other handout. It's a document we like to call a pipeline, which shows a variety of project sponsors, nonprofits, and public entities throughout the state that are in the process of developing supportive housing. If you notice, actually, on the bottom, you'll see that the total number of long-term homeless units roughly estimates over 300. The total number of units in these developments will be over 500. Again, I think this is a way that it kind of underscores my earlier statement about long-term homeless resources kind of lifting up the entire affordable housing industry. It's been able to be a good thing for projects that have been able to mix long-term homeless units in with other affordable housing units. And so in closing, I would just ask two things. One, that the legislature accepts and authorize the new nonprofit bonding strategy that's been outlined by Minnesota Housing. And two, if there is interest in increasing the pie and adding additional housing and homeless-related requests, I think that's a great thing, and I would encourage the legislature to do as much as they can in that area. I also ask that funding House File 2535 be your priority, and it should be fully funded. So at this point, I'd be happy to address any questions anybody would have.
Thank you very much. And finally, Michael Dahl, Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And I would like to second the thoughts that that George Stone had just talked to the committee about. We support the governor's proposal to do $30 million with the bonds for long-term homeless and the mechanism that is being proposed. I think it's good to sort of give you an idea of who we're talking about, and I'd ask that you take a look at the Star Tribune this past Sunday. I believe there was an article that talked about a man who had been living on the streets. He had lost his RV, no longer had heat. I don't know how long he had been homeless, but he had this dog that helped him make it through the day because he suffered from depression, anxiety. It was a companion animal, and he wasn't able to get into shelters and other programs. He was confronted by one of the street outreach workers, Monica Nilsson, who said, "If it doesn't mark and it doesn't bark, we'll get you into an apartment unit." That's an example of how you can use these long-term homeless housing units, bonds, to help someone into housing when they don't have it today. And that's a real-world example of how you can make a huge difference. I have also been talking to members that the Coalition for the Homeless supports the long-term homeless initiative. I hope that you fully fund it. But as George Stone has said, if there are additional resources to make a bigger impact, I think if we want to end long-term homelessness, and if we want to end homelessness, we can't have a sole focus. And right now, there's a permanent supportive housing is the sole focus of the governor's proposal. And I would ask that you please take a look at some of the other approaches that are used to address homelessness. Because as long as we're not supporting earlier intervention, we will add to the number of people who are experiencing long-term homelessness. The proposal we're talking about right now is to help the people who are already there. What about those who will come next? And so I just want to give you two examples that are types of people that would fall into long-term homelessness if there wasn't an intervention strategy. Tonight, I'm almost certain that there will be a teenage girl who will who's been abandoned, neglected, or abused by her family. She's made the right decision to flee. She needs help. She needs help right now. She doesn't need permanent supportive housing. She needs maybe some transitional support. And it'd be good to be able to have transitional housing programs in place to help this girl so she doesn't have to sell her body to have a place to stay tonight. And that happens all the time. Someone in that example could be homeless multiple periods, but I don't want to wait until those multiple periods are done. Secondly, and this is a case that we have across the state, there are veterans returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who have traumatic brain injury. And it takes a while to find out that that's the problem they're confronting. It looks like mental health problems, but really it's a physical health problem, traumatic brain injury, and you need to treat in very specific ways. Our homeless programs are seeing this across the state. I want to make sure that there is something available immediately to help these individuals so they don't have to become long-term homeless. And so I ask, if there are additional resources and this funding mechanism or not, that we need to take a look at the other approaches to address homelessness so that we can be successful in ending long-term homelessness. I have a handout that I gave to the committee that talks about successful approaches to ending homelessness, and they require outreach, emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. All are extremely vital to make sure we reach our goal. Thank you.
Thank you for addressing the committee, and we would invite, if there are any further questions of Ms. Orr, she is welcome to come back. If not, we thank you very much for talking about not only the mechanism, but setting it in the context of the challenge and encouraging continued interest in this particular issue. So that that bill is being heard in one of the finance divisions, and when we receive their recommendations, presumably we'll, I don't know, Representative Carlson may know this, whether it will come to us or whether there will be a supplemental bill that this one will be in, but we'll have to see how that proceeds. Transitioning now, members, those of you who are on the tour, I see Representative Wagenius is not here right now, but at every stop, I believe, the question was asked about how are you building this building. And that grew out of the language we adopted last year. We've adopted goals as a state for where we hope to be in the whole issue of the carbon footprint and impact on that. And then I saw a report that we may be hearing from some of the individuals about that some 46% of that impact comes from how we build buildings. And so I thought it might be a good idea as we get ready to build a lot of buildings to get just a little bit of education about what is the problem, what is the challenge, what is the, what are new developments in this area. And I don't know if we have a group of people who want to come together, come down together. Sheldon Strom, I'll introduce you first, Center for Energy and Environment. And do we have a number of people coming to the table together, or how would you like to deal with this?
Two at a time.
Two at a time. So we'll ask John Carmody?
Yep.
From the Center for Sustainable Building Research from the University of Minnesota.
Well, as we're getting set up here...
And members, this bill, there is a bill, Representative Knuth is the author, I don't see her in the room. This bill is being heard in the Energy Finance Committee, and there may be a recommendation from that committee. So in some of these instances, because we have a concept that rather directly relates to what we do, we thought we would give you a little bit of background. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strom.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Strom. I'm the director of an organization called the Center for Energy and Environment. And if we get this started, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're doing here. What I'd like to do is introduce the idea of green buildings and a concept called Architecture 2030, which I think is a fabulous idea. And then we have a number of people here that are really experts in this and have built a number of buildings that are really exceptional. So, Center for Energy and Environment, my organization, we've done a lot of work on energy over the years. We've done over 60,000 homes and businesses. We've done 100 different research projects. We started doing planning on reducing carbon emissions beginning in 1993 and 95. We've done a lot of these sorts of things. We've also implemented a lot of programs for utilities. We run lighting programs for a number of utilities. We do what's called building recommissioning, which is saving energy in large buildings. We offer programs for county governments. We also offer financing for a wide range of different types of programs. And we worked very hard last year on some of the energy bills that were passed. And I want to put this discussion into context. Last year, the legislature passed the Renewable Electricity Standard, which is probably the strongest renewable electricity standard in the country. Xcel Energy has to meet 30% of their energy needs to renewable energy by 2020, and others have to meet 25% by 2025. We also passed an energy efficiency bill that saved 25% more energy than the renewable energy standard. So those two things that the legislature passed last year were both huge undertakings. But to put them in context, the combination of both of those things reduces projected carbon dioxide emissions in 2025 by a little over 40%, which sounds great. But in an absolute sense, it essentially leaves 2005 levels of carbon dioxide emissions unchanged. So even though you've done a great deal, there's a great deal more to do. And that's where this idea of Architecture 2030 comes in. You've all seen charts showing where carbon emissions come from, a third from transportation, a third from electricity, and so on. Another way of looking at it is to look at how many carbon emissions are generated by buildings. And when you look at the carbon emissions from energy use directly in buildings and the energy use and carbon emissions associated with buildings, about 48% of our carbon emissions come from buildings. So it's a huge opportunity if we can really build some exceptional buildings. So there's an idea that I've just heard about from architects as I'm sort of sweeping the country. It's called Architecture 2030. And it's a little different than other green building initiatives because instead of specifying individual things you would do, it specifies the performance of the building. And it says we're going to build really good buildings. So our buildings in 2010 will be 60% better in terms of the fossil fuel emissions than they were in 2003. And in 2015, they'll be 70% better. And in 2020, they'll be 80% better. And by 2030, the idea is with energy efficiency and renewable energy, you could essentially build buildings that have no carbon emissions at all. And that's the Architecture 2030 concept that we're going to focus on today. This idea was supported by the Governor's Climate Change Task Force. There's a group called the Residential, Commercial, and Industrial Technical Work Group. And I think this was their favorite idea. They really liked this idea because the idea is we're going to really do the very best we can moving forward on developing new buildings. They had two caveats on that. One was we need to meet these really aggressive goals, but it's got to be cost effective. Now, that sounds like it might be impossible to do, but I think what you'll hear from the guys that have actually been building these buildings is doing this is cost effective, and meeting higher and higher standards will continue to be cost effective because electricity prices will increase, carbon costs will be included in energy costs, and technology is going to change and improve so we can build better and better buildings. The other thing that was important is that they didn't want these standards to end up as a mandate on local governments. And you'll see that the combination of the cost effectiveness of the measures and some of the other ways this is being handled and the grant in Representative Knuth's bill allow us to strongly support this concept and meet both of these guidelines. It's got to be cost effective and not be an unfunded mandate. And I think to give you more specifics on this, I'd like to have John Carmody go next.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is John Carmody. I'm the Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. And we do a wide range of things related to building research. But of most interest is we are the ones who led the team that developed the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines, which are now required on all state-funded projects. We continue to track and assist the state agencies with those projects. I was also on one of the working groups with the Climate Change Advisory Group for the state. What I'd like to talk about in my little segment here is just to give you a little overview of what's going on in the world of green building and sustainable guidelines and rating systems and standards. We've experienced a virtual explosion of interest and everyone trying to do the right thing that has hit in particular in the last 2 to 3 years. It's been building over about a 10-year period. But I think it helps to put this into context, and then it helps to understand why we're proposing this kind of 2030 idea. As Sheldon said, buildings had a huge impact. I don't think I need to go over that very much, but 65% of all the electricity consumption is in buildings. A third of the primary energy use, but as Sheldon said, up to almost half of the total energy use if you include the energy embodied in building materials and construction and so forth. And as you know, water, waste, resources, and so forth are all big, have big impacts from the building sector. When we look at the world of green buildings, you see, some of these might be familiar to you. You see the LEED rating system by the U.S. Green Building Council. You see another one called Green Globes. Those are national systems where you get points off of a checklist and you get a rating like a silver rating or a gold rating or a platinum rating. Embedded in those systems are a lot of good practices with energy, water, site, and so forth. You also see a number of regional systems. The bottom two on my slide are one from New York City, which was one of the early ones, and then our own Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines. And Minnesota pulled together a lot of expertise back in before 2004 and assessed all these systems and came up with our own version that we felt best served the needs of the state. I don't expect you to look at this, but what this is showing is that there's a long history of these guidelines going back to about 1990, and they started in England, they moved into Canada, then the United States. So when you hear about something like LEED, for example, those things are really only a few years old, but they've been built on this constant evolution and change, and fortunately or unfortunately, we're going to see a lot more evolution and change in the near future. We shouldn't treat any of these things like they're codified law, that we've got all the answers now. We're constantly trying to figure out how to do this. And you see some of those are for new buildings, others are for existing buildings. The other trend that's going on now is these guidelines, which are voluntary, where you get recognition and an award for doing a sustainable building, essentially. are now moving into being standardized and required in many ways. And so you have groups writing standards, which are then intended to be adopted into codes. So we're moving quickly from voluntary guidelines, standards, to codes, and not that that'll necessarily move that quickly, because codes are a slow process. But you're also seeing a number of them being required rather than voluntary. Now, when you look in the housing sector, you have a different array of guidelines available to you. LEED is kind of a dominant one nationally in the commercial building side, but it certainly isn't in the residential side. You have LEED for homes. LEED has a lot of different variations. But you also have the National Association of Home Builders has their own green building guidelines, which they're now turning into a national standard that'll be adopted by code. So the Builders Association have really gotten out in front on that one. But in Minnesota, we have really two different ones at play. One is Green Communities, which the people at MHFA who were just here have adopted as sort of the standard required set of guidelines for all affordable housing projects in the state. And then the Builders Association in the Twin Cities has adopted Minnesota Green Star. So it's a confusing array of things, and everybody has their own reasons for developing their own and so forth. And you can see here, again, there's a long history of these residential guidelines. In fact, in the United States right now, there's 85 different sets of green building guidelines, because they are very regional in character. Most cities or regions or states want to develop their own with their own local stakeholders and so forth. There's good reasons for doing it, but again, it makes it confusing. There's also guidelines at the development or the neighborhood scale. LEED has a new LEED for neighborhoods, which starts to address issues like district energy and things you can do with the infrastructure, the street systems, the storm sewer systems, and shared energy generation, as I said. And you, again, have regional variations. There's the Florida Development Guidelines, there's New York City Infrastructure Guidelines, and so forth. So the intent of that, we can certainly provide you with more information in detail if anybody wants it, and we have a paper and publications written on this, but the intent of my throwing all this up at you is to make you realize we're in a fast-changing time. We're in a time where there's a certain amount of confusion, but there's a lot of excitement that people want to do the right thing. What's valuable about this 2030 idea that Sheldon introduced is that it cuts through all of those guidelines and point systems and focuses on the real outcome. It says, we don't really care which of those guidelines you use, as long as you're saving X percent on your energy and X percent on your carbon. And so our research center is trying to help people understand that more clearly, so they get the outcomes they want and don't get lost in the minutia of all these competing guidelines and standards and rating systems. So in summary, the trends that I see that I think are going to continue, we have a diverse set of guidelines and rating systems continually evolving in response to the scale of development, building type, and regional issues. Guidelines are being adopted by states and cities as the basis for code standards and incentives. There's a movement away from simple point-based checklists toward more requirements and a focus on performance outcomes, meaning the actual energy use, the actual carbon emissions, the actual water use, and so on. Life cycle assessment of materials is beginning to be included. This is an interesting thing. In a sense, what we've done in the past is we've used best practices. We've said use recycled materials, use local materials, and so forth. All of those are good things to do, but they don't always translate into the best environmental or carbon or embodied energy effect. Now we have tools and information that let us do that stuff in more detail. So the science is rapidly evolving, and the information is becoming better and better every day. And then finally, there's, as I've said before, there's an increased focus on actual performance during operation. That means it isn't good enough to just design the building and congratulate ourselves on our calculations, but we have to look at how the building is operating. And that's very important because operation doesn't always match design. We need this feedback loop so we understand whether things were designed correctly and if they're being operated correctly. And this kind of leads into our next presenters, who will talk about another aspect of the state project on existing buildings and their energy use.
Okay. Dr. Mahoney, did you have a question to them? Or Well, you can, I mean, it's possible that our next four, why don't you try the question, and then if they're saying a future speaker will address it, we can wait.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Are these standards based on as built versus as lived in? So what I'm trying to get to is, build a 2,000 square foot house out in suburb XYZ with an unfinished basement, 2.5 car garage, whatever. Come along a couple years later, and you've got the heating system in, you've got the cooling system in, it's all designed as you want. If I finish off the basement, drop in two air ducts for heat, and hopefully I remember to put the cold air return in. What happens to your LEED building? What happens to your green ratings?
Madam Chairman and Representative, that's a great question. I mean, I think it goes to the last point I was trying to make, where it's one thing to meet a number of standards in design, which are kind of theoretical, and assuming the building is operated a certain way. It's another thing as to what actually happens. And, you know, in a large commercial or a state office building, you have that same issue in a big way. They may change the use of the building. They may change the number of people. They may decide to operate at two or three shifts. And so all of those energy projections are going to change over time depending on what's going on. And all you can say is that you have to look at the actual use of the building and kind of have this mentality of continually trying to improve, continually trying to keep your energy down and manage it effectively, not just assume you can walk away and the building will always be efficient. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I'm actually trying to get to a point here. You know, I've actually gone through, you've got four of them here, I've gone through the training class on two of them,
oh,
two out of the
okay.
four. And one of the biggest concerns, the practical people that actually put this stuff in, the engineers that actually have to think, one of the biggest concerns is if I pound a nail into the wall, penetrate the vapor barrier, I change everything. The control systems, having spoke with a couple of controls people, for all intents and purposes, says this is the best thing since sliced bread for control people, because put this into a building or a house, I get $1,000 a year to come in and fix the controls every year. Can you respond to that?
Mr. Carmody? Or if you think, we are going to several speakers who probably speak to some of the more practical issues, if you would prefer to see how they respond?
Yeah, I think I could maybe comment on that. We've actually done a lot of monitoring of energy use in buildings for decades. And the truth is that how the building is operated is a major determinant of its energy use. And that's why as we think about moving forward with this 2030 idea in Minnesota, we want to make sure, first of all, that when a building is designed, it's built as designed, so there's this mechanism called commissioning to make sure that it's actually built the way it should be, should have been, the way it was designed to be built. The other thing is we want to have operator training, and we want an ongoing system of evaluating the actual performance of buildings, because buildings are complicated organisms, really, and we need to monitor their actual use and learn from that and figure out how we can change some of our procedures to minimize energy use, because it's exactly a good point. It's not just building a structure. It's an entire system that's very dependent on the operator.
Madam Chair.
Just,
I do want to go on to the others, but again, I mean, I've had to repair a couple things that this legislature did years back in homes. So my concern with any green building, when you put these kind of constraints on it or expectations, and particularly in a home, you are setting up homeowners for a problem down the road because they don't have the expertise to operate the building.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there have been a lot of problems with homes in Minnesota and everywhere else in the United States. I think people thought it was simple to build a home, and it's not when you add in all of the things we want, air conditioning and all these other comfort issues we want. So as we're moving forward, I think people are well aware of that. Certainly the people that will be testifying here are well aware of that, and I don't think anybody's recommending anything that mandates any particular practice. I think we're talking about trying to come up with a way of helping the industry change itself so that they become better and better at doing this and giving them information to do it. Very different than I think some people did with building codes in the 1990s.
Representative Tinglestad, and then I think we're going to bring our next two speakers down because I'm guessing that the more information we get, the more helpful it is. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carmody, it's nice to see you again. I remember working with you in the late 1990s on these issues, and I'm glad to see that you're still involved and still a leader in this area, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
A question I have for you is, when we talked many years ago, it was a matter of pushing some of the architectural industry to go more in this direction. And I remember working on a project through the Elk River School District where their school board members actually designed the outcomes for a new building and really were dealt with a lot of hesitancy from the architectural designers. I'm wondering what you see as sort of an industry trend now. Is this really changing so the architects are grabbing hold of it, so this is part of the process more than just the owners of the building saying we have to have this sustainable guidelines and these long-term outlooks for the building?
Yes, I think there's been a revolution in this. You're going to see a couple of the next speaker.
I thought her question was probably a great introduction to the,
yeah,
to the next
it is,
speaker.
And these are some of the leading architects in the cities, and so it has been quite a turnaround, I'd say, even
so
in
would
5 years.
We will invite John White and Tom McDougall. Do we want to continue to do two at a time, or is that okay?
If I just make a comment,
yes.
I was conferring with my associate here, and we didn't realize how visionary Jim Hansen was years ago with his Muppet Kermit, who said, "It isn't easy being green."
They'll probably use that in a future presentation. Welcome to the committee, Mr. White and Mr. McDougall. Have I got the right names for the two people at the table? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is John White. I was the founder of the White Group. Tom, my partner, is the current president. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today. We will try to be brief. You've got some very good questions. Our role here today is to talk to you a little bit about what our experience has been in the last 30 years. The 2030 goals are very aggressive. They're very challenging. We believe in the long run they're achievable, but they're not a cakewalk. Talk about us just a little bit. We've been doing this now for 31 years. I founded the White Group in Chaska, Minnesota in 1977. We've got 583 verified projects. That means that, in fact, the project we're built is designed. The energy use has been verified and measured throughout the United States. We're now benchmarking, as part of the B3 project, about 5,000 public buildings, trying to see how public buildings are, in fact, using energy. Like Representative Mahoney, I believe in worshiping at the meter as opposed on the drawing board. We did win the Minnesota AI Firm of the Year Award, although we do not design buildings. We just help architects, engineers, and clients design them. We're a founding member of something that was called the Building Energy Performance Standards Committee back in 1975. So we've been doing this for a while. It's really cool to see it taking off again. And we're founding members of the ASHRAE 90 committee. That's basically the committee that sets national standards, energy standards. So far, we've helped reduce air pollution by over 604 kilotons a year while saving building owners more than $58 million. annually. We've done about 120 million square feet of commercial construction in the upper Midwest, again, as consultants, not as the architects or the engineers. We have 15 completed lead projects. We have another 83 projects on the drawing board, or I guess I should say on the computer screen, because we don't use drawing boards anymore, but I still kind of like them. The key points we'd like to make today is that energy conservation is a proven strategy, but it must be achieved through practical means. The goals are challenging. We believe they're achievable. Energy conservation, but not conservation, is and has been our goal since we started this project. It is probably the most significant environmental challenge placed before the building community since we've been in business. And it is not, as I said, a slam dunk, but we believe it can be done with thoughtful, dedicated owners, designers, and builders, and that means all of them. To help the committee get a little bit of a sense of where the state of the art is today, we took a quick look at about 441 projects that we've been involved in since the year 2000. That's about 59 million square feet of buildings. The energy savings on those projects range from 2%, not a lot, to 78%, an awful lot. Their average was 33%, and that average has been pretty consistent for about 15 years. It's just kind of, come on, guys, let's see if we can beat 33% one of these years. Represents, again, in the last 7 years, $26 million in energy cost saving. The average payback is about 2.5 years on these projects. The next picture it draws a line which says, if we, depending upon which one of these sustainable 2030 challenges we look at, let's say that black line that's running across the top of the screen and then stepping rather rapidly towards the right is current building energy use up till today, and then where we want that current building energy demand to go back to 2030. You can see, in fact, that line has drifted kind of high ever since I started in business back in 78. And we were going to get very aggressive about getting that number down. And the question is, can it be done? Well, like I said, we took a look at a bunch of these projects we look at, and we took a look at a closer look at some of them that we have pretty good idea of their energy cost, their energy consumption. We've verified, in fact, that they've been built the way they were designed to be built. How many of those, let's say, have reduced their energy compared to the current standard by about 60%. That would be making a 2020 target in terms of energy demand. And we found quite a few of them. In our particular sample, and this was not a rigorous research project on our part, but rather digging into the data that we have, we found about 25 projects since 2000 that, in fact, got below that 40% mark. About 1.5 million square feet, about 110 million BTUs of savings, $1.2 million per year in energy cost savings, and about 18% rate of return, which is...
I'm really curious about that one, just about 2003.
Yeah, the one at zero. We'll get to that on our next slide.
All right.
Lower than zero.
Yeah. All of these buildings were commissioned by Midwest clients. They were designed by Midwest architects and engineers, and they were built by Midwest contractors. In every case, the client chose to save significantly more energy by investing moderately more on the front end to get returns on the back. I'm going to give you three examples that we were quite intimately involved in. First example goes back to 1978, and I still remember it as one of the first projects I did as a consultant. Pat Hart was a guy, and he was president of a bank called Security State Bank in Wells, Minnesota. He chose to build a building that used about a third the energy of its contemporaries that day.
Representative Dunkey knows him.
Oh, what? He is fantastic. I'm sorry, Representative. He is a fantastic guy, isn't he? we revisited that building, by the way, in 2000 to mark its anniversary, and to sort of mark the year 2000, we did a presentation on the building at the International Solar Energy Society, and in fact, the energy use of the building at that time was 38% of what current code was. It had gone up a little bit because the building was so popular, they were using it a lot more at night, they were using the lower level, so they were using the lights more than had originally been projected. And that's what happens when things change. On the other hand, they had very efficient lights, so they were using the lights as efficiently as they could. The next building we want to point out is one that we were on the design team of back in 2000. That was the Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities. This is a group of utility companies who decided they wanted to build a building that would sort of lead by example. When they built that building, it cost 2% more. Their budget went up by 2% to put in the energy conservation features and natural daylighting features and so forth that they wanted, in addition to a wetlands restoration for water retention and so on. We monitor that building very carefully. The building uses 32% of the energy of its contemporaries that year, and it has a 28% return on investment. Third building is the one that's laying down on the bottom line. That was the Minnesota Energy, or the Science House from the Minnesota Science Museum. They challenged the design team to design a building that would use no net energy. That means someday it might run the meter forwards, but other days it produces energy and runs the meter backwards. The building has actually been a net producer of energy. It's returned 36% more energy to the grid than it consumes on an annual basis. What about practicality? What about return on investment? Well, return on investment is good. It's getting better. But you do see a decline. The more savings you want, the more, at least, more energy cost savings you want, the more your return declines. It costs more and more the closer you get to a 20% building. We're probably going to see economics, as John Carmody referred to, start to change some of that as there are more environmental and energy costs being added to running a building. But still, a 20% return, is, if I could get half of that on an annual basis, I'd be a real happy camper in my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And the last slide is a caveat. We do want to emphasize that the advisory committee and the people that are going to be working on this be highly knowledgeable in the area and knowledgeable about how buildings work and how buildings work in the Midwest. They must be committed to practical, real-world solutions. They must know how buildings and their systems work, how real-world clients, designers, and builders make decisions. And we can point to some examples of what happens when you have lofty goals with little practical knowledge. Sometimes even unlimited pockets are not enough, and they send a wrong message to the community. It can't be done at any price. And that's not a message that we believe that we can show folks. But those two little pictures you show buildings of approximately the same size and approximately the same geographic area. One is one we worked on, one we did not work on. One building with an photovoltaic system on it has net energy use about the same as the IAMU project, which Tom designed. Did the energy design on without a photovoltaic system. It costs over $500 a square foot. IMU cost about $175, something like that. Pretty much typical for a thing. Thank you very much. We'd
practical,
love to entertain questions.
Practical advice, Rep. MD.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's right. I really like what I see in your presentation as well as John Carmody's. We try to apply metrics to what we're doing. That's what you do for a living, to provide value to building owners in particular. What I'm looking for in this particular bill that we're looking at is trying to get the same metrics and outcomes that we are putting in, is to try to tighten up the language of the bill so that, number one, we don't cause undue cost to buildings without a return in value to the state and the taxpayers, number one, and number two, that we're not purchasing systems based on a tight value, or there's squishy language, green, or even LEED, in my opinion, is very subjective at times in terms of providing value to clients. So I was just curious as to whether you've read the text of the bill and if you have a comment on how that might be improved as we move forward through the process.
And that's either Mr. White or Mr. McDougall.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have read the bill. And being a numbers a bean counter rather than someone who writes legislation, I'm always fascinated by what I think it means versus whatever who wrote it thought it would mean. In this case, it seems to me that the bill that you're putting forward establishes a funding mechanism to get a team of experts together and figure out what the goals should be, what the methodology should be, how this state should approach building its buildings and trying to reach a goal of say, no carbon emissions somehow or another by the year 2030, a goal. Rather than spelling out the specifics of how it must do that, because the specifics, I spent 3 years in the Building Energy Performance Standards Committee, and boy, did we deal a lot of specifics, and it died on one point, and that was it the energy metered at the building, was the energy metered at the plant? So I'm very sensitive to those issues. I don't know if the intent of the bill was to start a process or to cap it. So I don't know if that's a...
And we'll hear from the author as a kind of concluding, so that's a good question to make sure that we get a response from. And any further representing questions? So we have the next two speakers, and then if there are further questions of the committee, you're probably all still around, Mr. Rick Carter and Douglas Pierce. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rick Carter. I'm an architect with LHB. I also work with Mr. Carmody on the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines as the project manager for the state, and I was also a member of the Climate Change Advisory Group. And what I'm going to do is walk you through a couple of just specific case studies, real-life examples, looking at some buildings that we've designed that have been in operation for more than a year, and using this context of the 2030 setting benchmarks and measuring performance so you can see sort of a comparison. So I've got three case studies. One is a private institution, Quality Bicycle Product, a distribution center. One is a Two Harbors High School, which I think is self-explanatory, and then the Allaire Veterans and Community Studio Apartments actually was a state-bonded project that is in St. Cloud that's up on the slide right now. Part of what I'm going to do, too, is just give you a little bit of definitions. I know it can be overwhelming with acronyms, but two of them I'd like you to pay particular attention to as we move forward in this whole idea of measuring outcomes of buildings. One is EUI, or Energy Use Intensity, and what that means is, and we're going to talk about this in all the examples, is measuring the actual meter use of energy in a building, normalized, combining all energy uses and normalizing it based on size and time. So the other acronym that I'm going to throw out here that's probably buried in this slide somewhere is KBTU per square foot per year. So that, simply put, is taking at least electric use and gas use in these three examples, combining them into one metric on a per square foot per year basis. So you can compare buildings to other buildings of like kind over a period of time. And I'm pretty simply just going to walk through each of the three examples. Interrupt me if you have any questions. Otherwise, we can take questions when we're completed. And I'm going to talk about the bar graph that's up here. There's four vertical lines. The first one is a building type average. So in other words, when I get to the school, as of the year, in this case, we use 2003 data. It takes all the schools in our region, which is roughly the state of Minnesota, and takes their average energy use on that metric, that KBTU per square foot per year. So going back to the previous presentation, it's a little bit different than comparing to code or a current building of its time. It's the set of buildings that are out there today. And that's the way this 2030 challenge has been positioned, because it's probably the way people can get their arms around this. The second column is a goal, and the current goal when you're designing buildings in the year 2007 is to exceed or be better than the average building by somewhere around 40 to 50%. So it's part of that straight vertical line that Mr. White showed in his last presentation. The third column over says projected. That's what we're doing, and it's a lot about what the White Group talked about more and more today, which is actually doing energy simulation. And we can do this for a house, and we can do it for a large institutional building. We can predict, using the White Group and other tools, we can predict the energy use making some assumptions about how that building's going to be operated, including plug loads and equipment, and we can predict its actual energy use. And then the fourth column, and this is where the news is relatively new and becoming very interesting and positive, is the actual energy performance. So the three examples I'm going to show you, we've actually had the building fully operational for more than a year, and we've collected gas and electric data and converted into these metrics. Okay? So the first example is quality bicycle products, and I'm going to talk about the bar chart briefly, and
Bloomington represents Peterson.
In Bloomington. It happens to be a LEED Gold certified building, but that's really just sort of an ancillary to the discussion today. So the average building type is the first column, the average building of this type, 108 kBTU per square foot per year. Our goal was 65. The model, which in this case was actually done for the white group, I can't read on my screen, is 47. And the first year performance is 42. So it would show up probably somewhere in that first slide that Mr. White showed, you know, somewhere around 40 or 50% of the average building of its type. The notes, and you don't have to be able to read that, but it indicates, and it's an important distinction here, that this particular building generates about 5% of its power on site. It has a 40 kilowatt photovoltaic system. So when you're generating renewable energy on site, you subtract that from the amount of energy you're using to come up with the net amount. So the 42 in the far right column takes into consideration that some of that is generated on site. And then the last piece, the piece in the green box there, talks about an additional cost, an annual savings, and in this case, a 10-year payback. Now, this is the longest payback of the three examples I'm showing, and that's primarily because a substantial chunk of that $750,000 went to purchase the photovoltaic system. And today, that's still a little bit of a stretch in terms of getting those paybacks down. The client, this was sort of the perfect scenario where they were able to get some grants. They've got depreciation, tax incentives. They're within the net metering cap in the state of Minnesota. They were able to justify it based on a 13-year payback. And I have to point out that when we're all talking about paybacks here, we're talking about assumption of flatline energy costs, which we know isn't going to happen. It's just the way we calculate paybacks. So. Second slide is Two Harbors High School, a project that has been operational now for about 2 years. 85 is the benchmark, and part of this is to determine what really is the benchmark, what is an average building. Because of the work that the White Group's been doing as part of the B3 project for the state, we've actually been able to look at actual energy use recently provided to us by a lot of schools in the state of Minnesota, and that 85 is proving to be a pretty accurate number. So again, our goal was 56. And we hit 54 in the first year of operation. This building doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. There's no photovoltaic system or geothermal. There's a displacement ventilation system, which is very efficient and very good for the occupants. But the cost, and the people on our design team wince a little bit when I use 240, thinking that some of that was really base cost. But in a very conservative measure, $240,000 that you could identify to increase the energy efficiency over code saves them $50,000 a year for a 5-year payback, or about a 20% return on investment. So the most economical of the three. And then the last one, before I turn it over to Doug, is the Al Air Studio Apartments. This project uses geothermal heating and cooling completely. There's no on-site renewable per se. The benchmark, and this is where this process comes in to validate some of this data, it looks pretty low, but approximately 50 kBTU per square foot per year is what we get for a multifamily project in Minnesota. So our goal is 32, a little bit maybe to our surprise, but pleasantly surprised we found out that after the first year it's operating at about half the average, or 25 kBTU per square foot per year. So in this case, we were fortunate enough, the project was bonded, it was designed to have geothermal, and early estimate showed that we were going to be over budget, so we actually pulled it out, and the project was bid just at about the right time, came in about $350,000 under bid. We put the geothermal back in. So essentially, it was at budget, even though it says $400,000 additional cost. It saved the St. Cloud HRA $50,000 a year, which they can use at least after 8 years of paying it back for programs, which is probably a better use than buying energy. So that's the end of my piece. I'll turn it
and
over.
The final. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. My name is Doug Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here on behalf of both Perkins & Will and also AIA Minnesota. Let me stop for a moment and bring up my PowerPoint, actually.
And we'll have to press just a little bit. We've got a committee coming in immediately after us.
I'll skip over some of the front slides and get quickly to the examples. For a brief response in terms of where the profession is in terms of responding to green buildings, I'll use our firm, Perkins & Will, as a possible example. We're the second largest design firm in the U.S. We have 21 offices around the country, 1,400 staff, and our sustainable design initiative is one of our most successful initiatives, and it's a major thrust of the firm. We have 750 LEED accredited professionals, 21 LEED certified projects nationally, and 80 registered. And locally in Minneapolis office, we have 85 staff, over 45 are LEED accredited professionals, and we have a range of clients that are pursuing and asking us for green buildings, everyone from Target to the Wilder Foundation, Great River Energy, Microsoft, St. Cloud Hospital, Northwestern College. The profession is really, I think John Carmody had said, we're kind of undergoing a revolution, and it's really starting to show. I'll pass through some of these slides. Most of this data has been presented. Just very briefly, the reason we're here today is related to the 2030 challenge, and really that springs through AIA Minnesota, the American Institute of Architects. And we have a set of benchmarks that we've adopted nationally. They're adopted locally. And in fact, the U.S. Conference of Mayors has adopted them, and they're also in the federal energy bill. So they start out at a 30 to 50% energy reduction, essentially through 2010 for buildings, and they escalate up to an 80% to 100% reduction in 2030. And this includes grid-sourced renewable power.
By the way, I did want to thank you on the slide before, since I'm reading those carefully, that you are endorsing public transit legislation. You're not not just looking at buildings, but thank you for that.
Thank you for noticing that. We adopted AIA Minnesota was the first AIA chapter in the U.S. to adopt a climate change position statement, and it includes things like includes energy efficient buildings, of course. Also, we endorse the renewable electricity standard. Fully endorse the idea of reducing carbon emissions 80% by 2050, public transit, and also compact community design. So Rick talked about some ways of benchmarking buildings and sort of measuring them. I have they're a very similar way of doing it, just a little bit different vernacular and language. You may see different percentages on the performance of buildings from different folks, different architects that you may talk to, different engineers. One way that we talk about it is how much better than Minnesota code are the buildings that we're designing, and that's basically a percent of energy cost savings. Another standard that you may see come up is the ASHRAE 90.1 2004 standard. That's how LEED measures the energy performance of buildings. And then Rick talked pretty extensively about the idea of sort of reducing energy based on the average energy use of buildings. So I point that out because the examples that I have use all three of those, or benchmarked back to different places. The first set of examples are benchmarked better than Minnesota code. And all of these buildings, except for the very last one, basically have a 2 to 5 year simple payback on their energy efficiency measures. So the first one right now we have in design in our office, this is a medical bioscience building at the U of M. Right now we just got the energy report back from the White Group. We're expecting this building to operate about 43% better than Minnesota code, And over 40 years, that should save the state in today's dollars and today's energy costs about $15 million. Molecular cellular biology was completed about 5 years ago. This building was modeled and projected to operate about 41% better than Minnesota code and save about 266,000 tons of CO2 over 40 years and save the state about $24 million, or the University of Minnesota about $24 million. McGuire Translational Research Facility, this has been completed for a couple of years. It's anticipated to operate about 43% better than code and save the U of M about $10.5 million over 40 years. The new science building in Winona, 42% better than code, $6.5 million in savings over 40 years. In addition to Fairview South Hospital, 33.4% better, a $1.6 million savings over 40 years. This is Medica's headquarters, 35% better on total energy. Medica would save about $4.8 million over 40 years. Alina, this is in the Midtown Exchange. Their build-out in an existing building was estimated to be 42% better than Minnesota code, $5.9 million savings. This is an image of the Wilder Center, which is just open. Actually, I have some slightly different benchmarks for this because we have some different data. This project is about will operate about 35% better than an average office building, and they're buying grid source green power, so they meet the initial 2030 challenge between now and 2010. And actually, it's designed to be about 40 to 45% better than Minnesota code with a 5-year payback. And then Great River Energy headquarters has about a 40%, it will operate about 40% better than an average office building in the U.S. They're buying green power. So from a 2030 benchmark standpoint, it really meets the 2010 through 2015 benchmarks for those for that challenge. And it's designed to be about 50 to 60% better than Minnesota code if you include the on-site renewable energy. And the on-site renewable energy accounts for about 10% of the energy performance of that building. And you can see this chart really sort of illustrates how at the moment we have to use multiple benchmarks to identify the performance of buildings. And one of the things we're really seeking is to set a regional standard based on the actual performance of buildings so we can sort of get all this clear with everybody in terms of how buildings are performing and with ourselves. So we believe that these targets are achievable, they're aggressive, and we can't do them alone. It will really require the participation of building owners, finance, the people that finance buildings, engineers, people that construct buildings, and the operators to really get the job done. But between 1973 and 1983, we actually were a pretty energy efficient nation. We flattened our carbon emissions during that period of time. We increased the GDP by $1 trillion. We added 30 billion square feet of new construction and 35 million new cars all at the same time.
Well, I have to say, this is, I mean, there is just incredibly impressive information. And as I looked through this, I thought a few of these, we have to share these with other committees. For example, there would be people on the higher ed committee who will be thrilled with some of the information you gave. Did you have a question, Representative Carl?
I think it led into what when you mentioned higher ed, all of your examples for commercial buildings for higher ed facilities. How about our K-12 schools? Have you had any experience with any of our local school districts?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, one of my examples was a K-12 school, the Two Harbor School. It was. Yep. Yeah, and it's an example, I'm sure, between our two firms. I would say that the K-12 sector maybe hasn't been quite as aggressive as the higher ed, but there's definitely a lot going on, and they're absolutely doing great things. Elk River's got some great exams. First LEED certified building in the state was a K-12 school.
And we have run out of time, but we thank you very much. And Representative Knuth, we were going to have concluding comments, but my understanding is the only bill that Energy Finance is bringing forward is yours. No, they do have more. So then we should invite you to wrap up. I thought you could come and make the presentation then. Thank you, Madam Chair. You guys got a lot of exciting background. But the Energy Committee is coming forward with recommendations on House File 1392. They've been put on, but I couldn't find the engrossment online. But improving our guidelines for energy efficiency for major renovations and state-sponsored projects, as well as some grants to local governments to do these sorts of things, was the highest recommendation out of that committee in that bill. But there were three bills, or three recommendations in that bill. Thank you very much. We'll hear that next week, apparently, and but we're happy that you were with us today.
And
thank you to all of the speakers. Obviously, you've given us a lot of good information and a good challenge for our time ahead. Representative Scalzi?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'd move the minutes of February 12th.
And
14th in the same motion.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes. Any additions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carries. Minutes are approved. And Representative Singleton.
I'll be real quick, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make note that on the sustainable building piece that we talked about for 2030, it was in the Wendt Group presentation, the 2002 Science House. They got their seed money from the LCMR, so I just wanted to make note that LCMR research, again, has paid off. Thank you.
Good. Meeting is adjourned.